Proud co-sponsor of Happening 2016, a homegrown music forum taking place February 27th from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Apano Jam Space in Portland. Happening 2016 will be an exploratory conversation about how the music scene works in Portland and how artists, professionals, and supporters shape the scene. Panelists include Simon Tam, Jenny Logan, DJ Cliff, and will be moderated by Rebecca Miller. Again, that's Happening 2016, a homegrown music forum taking place February 27th from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Apano Jam Space, 8114 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Pan-African Film Series hosted by the All African People's Revolutionary Party. The film this month is The Fall of Libya, showing Wednesday, February 24th at 6 p.m. at the Portland State University Smith Memorial Student Union in Room 329. The Fall of Libya is a short documentary of the role of imperialism played violently and illegally overthrowing the democratically elected Libyan government in 2011. Again, that's The Fall of Libya, Wednesday, February 24th at 6 p.m. at the Smith Memorial Student Union in Room 329 at Portland State University, 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. Again, that is 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, President Obama details his plan for closing Guantanamo.
Another Republican has entered the race for Ron Wyden's Senate seat.
The state's landslide map is getting updated for the first time since 1982. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, February 24th, 2016. I'm Erin J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett.
Oregonians concerned about landslides now have another resource for evaluating the danger. Today, the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries released a new map of earthquake risk in the state. The previous statewide map was issued in 1982. More than a third of Oregon's land has very high or high landslide susceptibility. Clackamas County, for example, has over 2,800 existing landslides. Landslides can be triggered by factors such as intense rainfall, rapid snowmelt, and freeze-thaw cycles. Knowing which areas may be susceptible to landslides helps people identify places to avoid during extreme weather. The map is available at the statewide landslide information database for Oregon at www.oregongeology.gov.
The anti-coal bill passed by the Oregon House last week has been amended before being sent to the Senate. Power companies negotiated directly with the environmentalists on the measure to head off potentially stricter requirements that might have come from a ballot initiative. If passed, the legislation would require Portland General Electric and Pacific Power to eliminate coal-fired resources from their energy supply by 2030. Changes made this week would mean the Oregon Public Utility Commission would be given more oversight over the proposed plan. The PUC would also get more authority to control costs expected from a shift towards clean energy to better ensure reasonable rates for consumers.
On the Oregon coast, there are more environmental problems to worry about besides just tsunamis. Bruce Menge, professor of marine biology at Oregon State, will speak on the environmental threat to Oregon's coast and coastal ecosystem at the Salem City Club Friday, March 4th at noon. Changing climate, ocean acidification, warmer water temperatures, stronger storms, coastal flooding, and increasing beach erosion are among the conditions he will examine. How will these changes affect residents, tourism, and the fishing industry? He will talk about recent changes like Oregon's new coastal marine reserves and ongoing studies to measure environmental impact on oceans, plants, and animals. The talk and luncheon will be at the Willamette Heritage Center, 1313 Mill Street Southeast in Salem, Friday, March 4th at noon.
In downtown Portland last night, Israeli human rights activist Jeff Halper drew a crowd of several hundred people. His topic was the globalization of the Israeli model of military occupation. He spoke about how the Israeli model involves maintaining fear among the populace in order to justify the military's takeover of all parts of everyday life. Here's an excerpt from his talk last night.
In my book about globalizing Palestine, I'm using Israel, I'm not saying this to demonize Israel. I'm using Israel as a vehicle for exposing to us how this global system works, and especially the military, security, and policing systems that I think, and this is why I wrote the book, the left doesn't know anything about. I don't know anything about it. You know, military, security, and policing together is a $2.5 trillion a year industry. The impact of that has got to be enormous on countries, and some of the countries that are the biggest consumers of weapons are, of course, the poorest countries. So socially, politically, economically, $2.5 trillion is a pretty big, and I don't know anything about that industry. How can I go about talking about globalization and world peace and all our issues, and I don't know what's going on with the $2.5 trillion industry and the technologies behind it of control? How are we going to resist that kind of a system if we don't really know the technologies? And I'm using Israel as a very useful, I think, because it scrambles. Israel's a little country. It's not like the United States that can impose $1 trillion a year on the world. Israel has to niche, and it has to scramble and find a way. How do we serve all the elites and the ruling classes and help keep them in power on different levels of the system? And that exposes the way this system of control works, I think, better than looking at a big country like the U.S. So you've got the global north, you've got the BRICS countries, and all of a sudden a whole different picture emerges. Here, you know, who's the greatest ally? Who's the greatest rival of the United States today? China. I mean, you're moving the whole Sixth Fleet into the Pacific. But look, Israel is the #2 arms supplier to China. And you know who #1 is? Russia. So here we've got a new Cold War beginning with Russia and Putin and China. And Israel is the #2 arms supplier, supplying them, of course, with American military technologies and so on. So what happens to our loyal ally in the Middle East? We share moral values. Netanyahu speaks in the Congress every 3 weeks. What happens to that? When you put $2.5 trillion into the equation, you don't have friends anymore. You have interests, and it bypasses ideologies. Look, Israel is the #2, 3, 4 largest arms supplier to India. Two of the largest militaries, both of which are supplied primarily by Russia. #2 is Israel. So that a whole different political picture begins to emerge when you begin to follow the threads of these military, security, policing relations. And then there's a third tier in the world, and that's the entire global south. The poorer countries of the global south, and Israel is present in virtually every one of those countries. Countries that the United States and Europe don't pay much attention to because they have poor economies or whatever. So that's the quid pro quo, but there's one other piece I'm gonna put in here, and that is capitalism. We don't talk about the world capitalist system very much. The only one that does so in a popular way is Naomi Klein, the shock doctrine, in her latest book on climate change and capitalism. I mean, she says it up front. But for the most part, we don't use that word. You don't talk about that word. Young people don't know much about capitalism. It's like, it's the sea we live in. You know, there's that joke about two fish, and one says to the other, how's the water? And the other fish says, what water? We're in this sea of capitalism that affects every bit of our lives, and we're not really aware of it. We don't grasp it because it's so encompassing. But, and one reason is that capitalism always tried to work by consensus, at least in the global north. It has a happy face. It's McDonald's, Ronald McDonald, and MTV, and all our toys, and Hollywood, and so on. But as the neoliberal system becomes more and more unequal, the 99% and the 1%, as Oxfam just put out a report last week, 2 weeks ago, literally 1% of the world's population controls 50% of its resources. And as people are becoming excluded, two-thirds of humanity are considered surplus humanity by the corporations. They'll never be educated, they'll never be productive in the sense of having jobs, and the worst sin is they'll never be consumers. And they're excluded. But these poor people in the global south happen to be sitting on top of very valuable resources that we need. You remember the bumper sticker from the Gulf War? How did our oil get under their sand? Remember that? And that's exactly. So as the system becomes more exploitative and more unequal and more people are excluded, including our own kids. That's the Occupy movement. Middle class kids that don't have jobs or certainly don't have job security and so on. And as it becomes more and more unsustainable in terms of resources and climate and so on, it has to become more repressive. And as it becomes more repressive, we move to another kind of war.
Israeli activist and author Jeff Halper speaking last night in Portland. The full talk will be aired this Friday at 9 a.m. on KBOO.
Bend businessman Sam Carpenter announced his candidacy for Oregon Senator Ron Wyden's seat today. Wyden started in Congress in 1980 and the U.S. Senate in 1996. Carpenter hopes to usher him into retirement. Carpenter owns a telephone answering service that employs about 40 people in Bend, and he also works as a business consultant. Issues he plans to focus on include public lands, healthcare, and the economy. He joins Lane County Commissioner Faye Stewart, 2014 Senate candidate Mark Callahan, and Dan LaShober of Wilsonville in opposing Wyden. No Republican has won a statewide office in Oregon since Senator Gordon Smith in 2002.
Purchases of new homes fell 9.2% in January in western states, where prices usually run higher than the national average. This is a sign of possible price pressure, even with low mortgage rates and job gains. Industry observers say the numbers paint a complicated picture because the share of new homes purchased but not yet built is at a 10-year high. The National Association of Realtors this week reported that inventory for homes remains tight and the number of people trying to take out a mortgage to buy a home is 20 to 30% higher than 1 year ago.
The Multnomah County Office of Citizen Involvement is gearing up for budget season and they are setting the table for you to give input on where your tax money should go. Here with us tonight to talk about how all of it works is Gary Marchkey from the County Office of Citizen Involvement. Gary, thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So first off, Gary, why don't you talk a little bit about why it matters that people even give input on budget and policy issues? What difference does it make?
Well, you know, I think it's particularly interesting now that we're in an election year that we'd be talking about this because it really, for me, breaks down the difference of between voice and vote. You know, there are more non-voters than there are voters. And for whatever reason, I mean, in some cases, it's citizenship or it's incarceration or it's just failure to register. Or it's just downright apathy. But voice, on the other hand, can be heard every day, all year long, every year in between election years regarding any issue that directly affects anybody, their family, their community, both locally, regionally, and nationally. So it really, for me, is about the difference that it makes is that your voice can be heard and your opinion can count throughout. Plus, it provides us with new voices, new perspectives consistently, new solutions. And those kinds of things are really critical as we learn how to integrate and learn from those dozens of new communities that we have and these newcomer populations that are part of our community. Community-led decisions are what some of the results of this kind of outreach and engagement is. And those things are the best kind. They're the most sustainable, and they're the ones that have the most impact on the communities. And, you know, really the bottom line is that most of the people that are most critically affected by especially the services that Multnomah County provides to the most vulnerable populations are typically the least represented. And so those voices really need to be at the table and need to be heard. And that's what our office tries to facilitate.
Can you give us an idea of the percentage of people who are registered and who are getting out to vote?
Well, I don't have the numbers through the election department of the people who are registered to vote. But I do know that a small percentage of those who are registered to vote actually vote. So really what we're looking at is better than or less than half of the people who are eligible to vote typically vote. And of course, we know that we don't have the majority of our population these days, it doesn't seem, that are even eligible to vote.
Yes. Why don't you talk a little bit about your own background as well? You have a lot of community ties, and I've heard a rumor that some people may have even heard you out singing Frank Sinatra at public events. So why are you doing this work? How'd you get into it?
Well, it's certainly not to further my singing career, that's for sure. But yeah, actually, I've been known to croon at karaoke and colored pencils, art and culture events, but that's another conversation. And actually this Friday at the Jade Lounge, but that's another one. So basically, though, the reason that I do this work is to give voice to those that want and need to be heard. I mean, that's the bottom line. You know, I've decided that I want to make civic engagement as easy, eight-year-old simple is what I call it. And the reason I use eight-year-old is that way back in 1960, when I was 8 years old, that's just between us, okay, I was just after my dad died, and I was called actually by Jerry Lewis, directly to raise money for his kids. And I got all the information, all the tools, everything I needed to empower an eight-year-old in 1960 to go out and raise money for Jerry's kids. And I want to make civic engagement that simple for everybody. I really think that that's the key, because really if that happens, that's the catalyst for change.
And if people out there listening are interested in educating themselves a little bit more about how they can give budget input, where can they go? What can they do?
Well, funny you should ask. We have currently an online budget survey where we're updating our 2014 survey, setting budget priorities, asking really tough questions like, here are 15 services the county provides. Tell us your top three. All right, so those are not easy questions, but we have an online budget survey at multco.us/OCI, and that will be going to our, it'll close on March 31st, and then we will take that information back and present it to the county commissioners. We also, through the chair's office, have participated in listening sessions that are scheduled all over the community. Budget hearings. There are outreach budget hearings happening at ERCO and other places around the community. All of those events and some others are on our web calendar at that same multco.us/OCI website. Everything isn't on there, but there's a lot on our web calendar that you can check out, including all those listening sessions and budget hearings. We also have programs called County Budget and Testimony 101, which are basics around what the county does and doesn't do, how the budget works, and how you can be engaged. And also, if you ever have a mind to want to testify or in some way, shape, or form meet with your legislators, what should you be going through to do that? So that's the Testimony 101. We've hosted leadership trainings, and we continue to offer the opportunity to host leadership trainings in the boardroom or in the county building with a variety of leadership programs. So we really are trying to do our best as an office with the resources that we have to reach out to the community and just facilitate whatever the community needs to be engaged and feel comfortable doing that.
And is there anything else you'd want to mention about the public policy side and how people might get involved?
Well, interestingly enough, you know, we don't separate policy and budget because policy informs budget and budget informs policy. At the same time, besides the things I previously mentioned, you know, input through our budget advisory committees is really an important way to affect public policy. What we like to say is that nothing reflects your values, especially as an elected official, like how you spend our money. So if you follow the money, you find out where the real values are, not just the lip service.
All right, so let's get back to the specifics of the Multnomah County budget here. Are there certain hotspots in the budget that listeners might want to know more about and potentially get involved in?
Well, there are, although I would say that first and foremost, our committee, the Citizen Involvement Committee and our office, which serves the committee, are about process, the process of community engagement, not necessarily specific issues. That being said, public health is really very high and hot on the list. You know, this holistic coordinated care program brings together all the social determinants into one particular discussion and one equation. Things like housing, mental health, employment, education, even zip code come into play when you're talking about health. So any public health discussion is really hot. Also relative to that, community benefit dollars. All of these dollars that these nonprofit hospitals are now saving because of the Affordable Care Act, where is that money going? How is that money being spent? And who's making the decisions on that? That's another hot one. Diversity, really. And that, you know, our community includes dozens of cultures that weren't here. We didn't even know about probably 25 years ago. Now we live together in many cases in isolated and insulated communities. And we need to find ways, new and existing, for these perspectives that are represented by these communities to be heard and integrated into how our government does business. Because there's so much to be learned from other communities and other ways of doing business if we just listen.
So if people are interested in getting involved here and are curious about how they might make the greatest impact, can you talk about the different types of input they can give and how they can have that impact at the county level? I know sometimes people feel a little disenfranchised and as if they can't do anything. So where should they start?
Well, we have a system that 30 years old, founded in 1985 when our Citizen Involvement Committee and therefore our office was founded, called the Budget Advisory Committee System. And basically what that does is that's members of the community who work through their committee with members of each department in the county around their budget priorities, how they're spending their money, and how they recommend they should be spending their money. That's a very well-oiled machine. There are a limited number of opportunities there, but what we're after is changing the grade of oil that goes into that machine by opening up other opportunities that don't necessarily involve serving on that committee and showing up for meetings and doing all the things that committees do. We want to, in reaching back with our partner communities, to find ways that don't currently exist that will get our unengaged people more engaged. So that's really the system we have is great. It's wonderful. And if there's a place to plug in, we'd love to. But we really want to explore other opportunities that don't currently exist and work for the communities that we're trying to reach to.
So as taxpayers, we do tend to find out about our county services when they aren't working and we're inconvenienced. So can you talk about some of the items on budget and policy agendas that you think we should be aware of more proactively?
Well, I think when we talked about health, I beat that to death. I think health is huge, and because it's so holistic, it covers so many different areas. Housing, which is part of the health equation, but it's also a matter of public input and community-driven projects around where that housing should be, how that housing should look and be built, for whom it should be accessible and where, and how much it ought to cost, both in terms of building and in terms of making available to folks. So these are all community decisions that are best made by the community themselves if they have the opportunity and someone is able to facilitate the process. We're the Office of Citizen Involvement and the Citizen Involvement Committee are committed to doing that. So I think those are, and that's why I said public engagement is really the other area. People need to be heard. And we have a responsibility to help them understand where, how, and when.
So how can listeners get hooked up with some of these programs and events?
Well, we have a website, a fairly active current website at multco.us/OCI. We have a Facebook page, which we would love it if you would like and share. We are, rumor has it, on Twitter, but neither Brenda in my office nor myself have a clue how to use Twitter. So if anybody out there knows how we could use it, we'd love to hear from you. We also are going to be at events like the Selwood Bridge opening and Rock the Block. And there's Old School. Just drop by for a visit. Our office is directly to your left as you walk into the building.
That was Gary Marchkey from the Multnomah County Office of Citizen Involvement. Thanks, Gary.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And you can catch up with them once again at www.multco.us/OCI.
7 years after announcing his intention to close the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, President Obama has delivered his plan to send some prisoners to other countries and others to U.S. prisons. House Speaker Pete Ryan criticized the proposal, saying it left out critical details and violated laws regarding the transfer of detainees in terrorism cases. Opponents fear that released prisoners may return to terrorism, but President Obama is urging Congress to give his plan a fair hearing. There are nearly 90 people still being held at the prison.
The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has dismissed a second and final felony charge against former Texas Governor Rick Perry. The charges most likely help sink Perry's 2016 presidential bid. Rick Perry was indicted on charges of abuse of power in 2014 after he defunded a statewide public integrity unit in an effort to force the resignation of a district attorney.
On Tuesday, Spike Lee released a 60-second radio ad in South Carolina endorsing Bernie Sanders for president. In the ad, the film director specifically cites Sanders' civil rights record and his campaign's independence from corporate contributions. While he has support from 65% of black voters according to a CNN poll, Sanders' campaign hopes endorsements like this will help increase his support from black voters ahead of South Carolina's primary on Saturday.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
For WIN, I'm Joanne Powers. Economic Policy Institute Senior Economic Analyst Dave Cooper says raising the federal minimum wage to $12 an hour would save American taxpayers $17 billion in public assistance spending. That because many corporations pay workers so little they qualify for public assistance programs.
The point is that if we want low-income families to be able to have a decent life, we need to take a closer look at what they're being paid and what we're expecting of businesses. Big corporations are achieving extraordinary profits at the same time that their workers are relying on food stamps.
Cooper says huge tax savings are possible through raising wages.
Well, there are many things we could do to lift wages, but the most straightforward is to raise the minimum wage. Increasing the federal minimum wage to $12 by 2020 would lift wages for over 35 million workers nationwide and generate about $17 billion in savings to government assistance programs. That $17 billion could then be used to make our anti-poverty program stronger or make long overdue investments in education or public infrastructure.
The Chicago Teachers Union says privatized nursing services are driving Chicago schools to the brink of a health crisis. A report called Nursing Services at CPS says an epidemic of outsourced nursing services is affecting the health of 400,000 students throughout the Chicago school district. The union will present its findings to the school board Wednesday. The Chicago Teachers Union says RCM Technologies got a $30 million contract from the school district in 2015, but the union says the company is failing to meet its obligations. Some school nurses are reporting stories of RCM staff untrained to deliver basic tasks and a high turnover rate for outsourced nurses. The union says this outsourcing of nurses is designed to ultimately eliminate union nursing jobs, replacing them with temporary nurses with no job protection or employment benefits. Teamsters workers Tuesday protested the $10.3 billion purchase of Airgas by the French company Air Liquide. Bringing their protest to the Houston headquarters of Airgas, the workers demanded that Air Liquide stop its attacks on workers and their unions. Teamsters General Secretary Treasurer Ken Hall says Air Liquide and Airgas have been conducting a campaign of wage discrimination, threatening workers with loss of health care, benefits, and wages during collective bargaining, and attempts at union busting by threatening union activists. The Teamsters say the company would never get away with treating its French workers this way.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender, offering a wide range of treasury management services designed to control cost, improve cash flow, and simplify accounting for unions. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the VU. This will be followed by The Underground, produced by the KBOO Youth Collective at 6 o'clock. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should be warm, with temperatures maybe up to 65 degrees and sunny. Today in history, on February 24, 1803, the United States Supreme Court decided the matter of Marbury versus Madison, by ruling that any act of Congress which conflicts with the Constitution is null and void. The quote of the day comes from Groucho Marx, who said, "Outside of a dog, a book is man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read."
It's 5:30, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Big news, people, especially for those of you upset by the skyrocketing prices of the essential prescription medicines you take, including thousands of patients who were hit last year with a 5,000% increase in one life-saving drug. Determined to do something about those despised price hikes, drug makers themselves have reached into their corporate toolbox for the two most effective means they have to fix their price problem. Of course, putting more corporate cash into research to produce new medicines would be one of those tools, and a renewed commitment to honest competition would be the other, right? Right. But Big Pharma gave up years ago on doing right, turning to two other corporate tools that have reliably generated a gusher of profits for them: advertising and lobbying. So here they come, wielding bigger-than-ever ad and lobbying budgets to deal with that pesky matter of public anger at drug company price gouging. The intent of the multimillion-dollar PR blitz and intensified offensive in Congress is not to restrain the gouging, but to improve the industry's image in hopes of restraining lawmakers from taking steps to rein in prescription costs. Of course, their ads dishonestly fail to mention this selfish intent, instead pitching drug makers as selfless saviors of humanity. They feature soft scenes of drug researchers in white lab coats urgently trying to find new cures, scripted testimonials from people posed as patients who've been saved by Big Pharma, and of course, scenes of drug makers altruistically aiding poor people. This is Jim Hightower saying, so, you see, the industry is spending millions on this corporate medicine show not to protect its notorious profiteering, but to protect you from public officials who might try to stop them from overcharging you. These incorrigible gougers are enough to make you sick.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
As many as 8 separate indigenous communities along the banks of the Amazon in northwestern Peru continue to clean crude oil from a series of pipeline ruptures which began in late January. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with an expert at Amazon Watch about the regularity of such incidents, as he estimates there has been as many as 20 spills over the last 5 years.
I'm talking with Andrew Miller, and he is the advocacy director at Amazon Watch, and we're going to talk about the series of oil spills in northwestern Peru, or has the locale expanded?
These oil spills are in the northern Peruvian Amazon.
And reports indicate as many as 8 indigenous communities are feeling the impact from this series of spills. How many people does that represent?
The original spill, which happened a month ago tomorrow, affects 8 communities, and the numbers of people that I've seen are in the thousands. I think it's 5,000 for that first spill, and then the second spill that happened earlier this month also affected a series of other communities and several thousand additional people.
So reports of a third spill are waiting for confirmation?
There were reports of a third spill. Proven government authorities have said that actually what it is regular maintenance on the pipeline. But even if that turns out to be the case, these most recent spills are just part of roughly 20 oil spills that have happened over the course of the last 5 years. So this is a regular occurrence along this pipeline, which was built decades ago and has been needing repair and upgrade and maintenance for several decades.
Do you have any feel for what the expected shelf life of these pipelines are?
Now, I'm not an engineer, but I think any system over time begins to corrode, and especially pipelines, which are transporting a highly toxic, highly corrosive substance. And this is something, again, that we've been seeing many times in recent years. It's like a big scandal every couple of years when this happens. And it's sort of like the same pattern repeats itself, where there's an oil spill, the government pretends to clean it up, but often what they do is they simply put dispersant on the oil, and so it just sinks under the water, offering the appearance of it having been cleaned up. But in fact, much of the oil is still there. They basically just try to cover it up. The communities continue to have to try to drink this contaminated water. And then when the sort of media focus subsides, the government stops worrying about it so much until the next oil spill. So we see this pattern repeated over and over. A particularly shocking aspect of this is that often children end up being involved in the cleanup effort. And this happened in 2014, and we're seeing allegations of this happening again in the recent spills, where in addition to the workers that are going out to clean it up, we also see children, often indigenous children from the local communities, are also going and essentially immersing themselves in this crude oil, which we can only imagine is incredibly toxic and causes all kinds of skin problems in the short term, and we can imagine health consequences in the long term. That's a pattern we've also seen over and over.
The local regulatory body is the Agency for Environmental Assessment and Enforcement, says Petroperú could face fines as high as $17 million if the spill is causing health problems for local populations. Do you have any feel for what criteria is going to be used to determine that, or how long that process might take?
Well, unfortunately, that regulatory body, and we know some of the people who work there, they're very well-intentioned. They're very committed to the issues, and they do what they can within the constraints that they're working under. But unfortunately, what we've seen is even when fines are levied against oil companies, it often goes into this long legal appeals process. So that process could theoretically drag itself out. We would like to think that those level of fines would help change the calculus for the companies to actually put in the investment on the front end to avoid these kinds of spills happening. But we see this in Peru, and we see this elsewhere in the United States and around the world, where often the fines, even if they're actually paid, are still less than the investment that companies would need to make to not pollute in the first place. And so even if they pay the $17 million, it's possible that the company will continue to feel like it's better to run the risk of the fine than to just upgrade the pipelines in the first place. It is important to note that there are offices, there are aspects of the Peruvian government that are trying. They're making an effort on behalf of the communities, they're making an effort on behalf of the environment. But often those aspects of the government are not very powerful relative to the big ministries that are pushing the oil industry, that are pushing extractive industries throughout the Amazon and other parts of the country.
For folks wanting to know more about the situation and the political dynamics, have you a website that you might refer them to?
We would encourage folks to go to the Amazon Watch website, www.amazonwatch.org. And we've been posting blogs about the situation. We just launched this urgent relief fund, and we would certainly encourage folks to contribute to that. People can also take an online email action and send an email to the Peruvian prime minister, encouraging them to take this situation very seriously. Those kinds of actions, I think, are very important. And then also on social media, we're reposting a lot of articles that are coming out about the situation, so people can find us on Facebook or Twitter, and we've been posting a lot of information about the situation in Peru.
I've been talking with Andrew Miller. He is the advocacy director at Amazon Watch. For more information, you can visit their website at amazonwatch.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
In a call to President Vladimir Putin Wednesday, Syria's President Bashar al-Assad indicated he is ready to plan an end to the violence of Syrian civil war. But at the same time, both presidents promised to continue fighting the Islamic State and the al-Qaeda affiliate, the Nusra Front, and other terrorist groups. The United States and Russia have reached an agreement for a Syrian ceasefire scheduled to begin Thursday evening, even as Turkey continues to shell Syrian territory. Meanwhile, the UN successfully airdropped 21 tons of humanitarian aid to Deir al-Zore for the first time since the city fell to the Islamic State in January.
Islamic State militants used mustard gas in an attack against Kurdish forces in Iraq last year. The chemical causes severe delayed burns to the eyes, skin, and respiratory tract. According to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, lab tests have revealed that 35 Kurdish troops were sickened in a battle in August by their exposure to mustard gas. This seems to indicate that the chemicals came from Syrian stockpiles, which were never fully destroyed. The Syrian government has consistently denied the existence of chemical weapons. Mustard gas use has already been confirmed in Syria itself.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Wednesday, February 24th, 2016. Israeli troops to demolish killed Palestinian homes in the West Bank and Navy attack fishers in Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers invaded early on Wednesday at dawn several Palestinian districts in occupied West Bank, stormed and violently searched homes, and kidnapped 17 Palestinians, the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, said. The PPS stated that the soldiers invaded Hebron City and several nearby communities in the southern part of the West Bank and kidnapped 8 Palestinians. The soldiers also kidnapped 6 Palestinians during various invasions and searches of homes in the Ramallah and El Bira district. Another Palestinian was kidnapped in the Kalandia refugee camp north of Jerusalem, while a teenager was kidnapped from his home in Abu Dis town. One man was also kidnapped after soldiers searched homes in Nablus city, northern West Bank. In other news, Israeli forces on Wednesday handed the families of 3 Palestinian teenagers who were recently killed by the Israeli troops notices of their intent to demolish their homes located in Kabate town, south of Jenin, according to security sources. Forces broke into the homes of Ahmed Zakarna, Tawfiq Abu Rob, and Ahmed Abu Rob and notified their families about their intention to demolish the homes of their families on February 29th as a collective punishment against them. The 3 were shot dead by Israeli police in Jerusalem on February 3rd after allegedly carrying out a stabbing and a gunfire attack which killed one Israeli policeman. Elsewhere, the Israeli Navy ships opened fire Wednesday on a number of Palestinian fishing boats near the shore in central part of the Gaza Strip and northwest of Gaza City, causing damage. The Navy fired dozens of rounds at the fishing boats while they were only 4 nautical miles away from the Gaza shore, forcing the fishers to go back to shore without being able to fish to provide for their families. The Navy also opened fire on fishing boats in the Sudania Sea area northwest of Gaza City, causing property damage, local sources reported. The Israeli Navy frequently attack fishing boats in Gaza and repeatedly kidnap fishers and confiscate their boats. Such attacks lead to dozens of casualties, including many fatalities, in addition to the abduction of many fishers. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, February 24th, 2016 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imenc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Ishmawi and me, Ghassan Bandura.
Are encouraged to bring, tomorrow night, fans of the old Selwood Bridge will have one last chance to say goodbye. The old bridge will permanently close to traffic that day at 7 p.m. and from 7:30 to 8:30, people can walk across the 90-year-old bridge. Walkers are encouraged to bring flashlights, electric candles, and phone lights. A bagpiper in kilt will lead the gathered friends of the old bridge as they bid it farewell. Participants are asked to assemble on Grand Avenue off of Spokane Street near the bridge's north sidewalk, no earlier than 7 p.m. The new bridge will open to traffic at 6 a.m. on March 1st. The four-year project was completed on time but is already over budget with months of work still remaining.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jeff Henderson, Dan Raphael, Galen Sanford, Jimmy Tardy, and Jenka Soderberg. The producer is Robin Ryan. Our engineer is Galen Sanford and Jimmy Tardy. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock is Democracy Now! With hosts Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joanne Hardesty hosts Voices from the Edge. She'll talk about the Portland City Council vote to move Right to Dream 2 homeless camp to Southeast Portland. She'll also discuss the city launch of the Homeless Toolkit. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, we speak with Diane Lebeck about her new novel, Breaking Wild. The story features two strong women characters, one lost in the woods of Colorado, the other obsessed with finding her. And at 11:30, the film show welcomes Ethiopian director